Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast. I'm Kelly Ash, senior researcher at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. We are a private, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization based in rural Minnesota, where we are dedicated to providing data-driven research on rural issues to help our policymakers make more informed decisions affecting the rural people and places of our state. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about census funding, not only decennial census, but other products produced by the Census Bureau. I have two guests today. I'm going to first introduce Joan Namark, who's the executive director for the Minnesotans for the ACS. Joan, welcome. And if you wouldn't mind just providing our listeners a little overview of your organization.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm really pleased to be here today. MACS is how we talk about ourselves, Minnesotans for the American Community Survey. We're a relatively new Minnesota nonprofit. Our mission is to educate Minnesota communities about the critical importance of accurate census data to drive a strong economy, sustain healthy communities, and improve the well-being of all Minnesotans. We have two focus areas. One is educating policymakers to make sure the Census Bureau has the necessary resources to collect accurate and relevant data, and two, engaging the public about what's at stake, why it's important to respond to the census. Most people know that the U.S. Constitution requires the census for purposes of fair representation in Congress, but they don't know that $34 billion in annual funding comes down from the federal government to local communities every year based on data in the census and ACS. We began as a volunteer coalition in 2012 to respond to a specific threat to the census. A few members of Congress introduced legislation to defund or eliminate the American Community Survey, and those challenges continue now. So for over a decade, we have educated and engaged Minnesota grassroots and grass tops in the importance of the data for local communities and policy issues, like the things that you do there at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. In 2022, we became a Minnesota nonprofit organization. We launched our rural initiative. I want to be sure and mention that. And we hosted Census Bureau Director Rob Santos in Minnesota in July to learn more about Minnesota's communities and data needs. We have a really deep focus on data accuracy and equity. So Kelly, thank you so much for hosting this podcast today.
Yeah, thanks, Joan. And I've been with the MACS group for probably about 4 or 5 years now working on some stuff. And when we get into the conversation, we'll talk more about this. But one thing, as a pretty consistent data user myself of census products, I was a little astounded, I guess, at the amount of administration that happens in the back, as well as the funding that needs to be there. I think we all just tend to take it for granted that the data will just always be produced and be there. So thanks for being on the program and talking more about this. My other guest, Mary Jo Mitchell, who is the co-director of the Census Project. This is my first time getting to speak with you and have you on. I've heard about the Census Project through Joan and through other avenues. And so I'm really happy to have you here. If you wouldn't mind just taking a minute or two to kind of talk about what is the Census Project and what you guys are up to.
Thanks, Kelly. Delighted to be here today to talk about all of these issues and to represent the Census Project. The Census Project, of which MACS is a member, is a coalition of over 800 national, state, and local organizations, all of whom have come together in support of ensuring that the Census Bureau has sufficient funding to conduct, in particular, the decennial census and the American Community Survey. We're a unique coalition among those based in D.C. in that we are so diverse. We like to say we represent everyone from the Chamber of Commerce to the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. We're able to bring all these diverse voices together because of the broad mandate of our coalition. And all of these organizations represent data users and members from the public, private, nonprofit, and academic sectors collectively.
Great. Thanks for being here, Mary Jo. Really appreciate it, getting your perspective today. As I was talking about at the beginning, I tend to use a lot of census data, a lot of different products. Most folks probably know the decennial census, right? That's pretty well known across the country. But maybe some of the lesser known products that the Census Bureau produces are the American Community Survey, IPOMS. There are quite a few others that I tend to use actually more than the decennial census because it tends to have even more of the economic information that we're looking for our research. But I think, you know, just to provide some context. You know, I think folks would believe that the census gets its funding and it does a decennial census and that's it. But there's a pretty cyclical nature to this. They're already preparing for the 2030 decennial census every year. They're still putting out the American Community Survey and all the other types of products. Mary Jo, I'm going to turn it to you. Would you provide our listeners just a little context and how does this funding work and why it's a little bit unique and maybe even a bit hard to track and kind of falls through the cracks in terms of people paying attention?
You bet. And you coined the phrase right when you described the Census Bureau's funding as cyclical. That is what is unique and challenging about the Census Bureau's funding. Unlike most federal, and I venture to guess state agencies, the Census Bureau's budget does not hover around a baseline. Its funding is largely driven by the decennial census cycle. So that's what makes it cyclical. It ramps up over the course of the decade as the agency prepares for the decennial census, starting to reach a peak from the middle of the decade to the highest point of funding in the year ending in zero. So as an illustration, the 2010 census life cycle cost was about $12.5 billion, and about half of that was spent in the last year of the census. The 2020 census is still costing us because they are still closing out some related activities. But by the time they complete their work, they will have spent roughly $13.7 billion.
So a little bit of an increase. A lot changed. They had the pandemic. They had to pivot quite a bit in terms of the way they were going to distribute the survey and get their responses. How dependable has funding for the decennial census been? Is it something that they've been able to depend on and know that it will come to them? Or is it something that every year or every decade just really always needs to be fought for and they need to really explain why it's important?
Joan, if I may jump in. great question, Kelly. I would say that it has not been dependable, and we really saw the funding jeopardized in the ramp up to the 2020 census. In fact, because of funding cuts and delays, the Bureau had to cancel or delay some of the critical tests that they had planned for the middle of the last decade in order to adequately prepare for the 2020 census. And several of those tests were to have occurred in rural and remote communities, which I know is of interest to your listeners. And those tests would have told us a lot about the ways in which the agency could have potentially improved the count, not just in rural areas, but also improved the count for historically hard to count populations, including American Indians, children under the age of four, renters, and Hispanic and Black households. And we believe, as you may know from the outcome of the 2020 census, that the high undercounts of some of these populations, especially in rural areas, can be traced back to the fact that the Bureau was unable to really do the kind of ground level foundational work that they had planned to do in order to understand what strategies might have improved the count in these among these populations and especially in rural remote regions.
Yeah, I'm hearing that quite a bit just among my peers and colleagues that use the census and like to compare, obviously, from decade to decade. It was a little bit, some of the numbers we got back were surprising. Some of them maybe a little, I don't want to say unbelievable, but I think there is some questions as to what did the pandemic cause in terms of maybe some of these weird changes we saw in the data over the timelines, and what was also just due to unreliability in some of the census gathering. And I know there was some anger and frustration expressed towards the Census Bureau, but at the same time, they're between a rock and a hard place. They can only do so much with the funding they have, right? And so it's a very challenging position. And as a rural practitioner that uses data all the time, the decennial census is one of those surveys that we really depend on because it is a population survey. It's the only one that actually gathers information of the entire population. We don't have to worry about margins of error and inaccuracies typically in the decennial census. Now, some of the other products that the Census Bureau produces, such as the American Community Survey, Joan, we love to use that because it has a lot of different variables in it, and it's really well done, but does come with a margin of error, can be problematic for rural areas in terms of its accuracy because it's more of a random sample survey. Joan, some of the different changes in funding and some of the fights that have happened, have you seen that kind of impact the ACS at all, and what has that looked like?
Yeah, thanks, Kelly, for that great question. There are a lot of other Census Bureau products, and but I the one I'm most familiar with is the ACS, the American Community Survey. As you know, it includes a ton of detail: income, education, employment, childcare, housing, broadband, which are big topics in your research agenda. From 1940 through the year 2000, it was known as the long form, and it came out at the same time as the decennial census. But in 2005, it was decoupled from the decennial cycle, and it has been an annual survey ever since then. So a lot of the people on this podcast, your listeners, will probably remember some of that, but it's getting to be pretty ancient history at this point. And so because it's a sample instead of the survey, the actual census itself, it becomes much more difficult to get the accurate data. And I know you and I have talked a lot about sample size and margins of error and that sort of thing. But just to give a little background on that, the long form did have advantages. Even though it was once a decade, it was collected from a much larger survey, 1 in 6 of the population. But, and most people forget this, there was an oversample in rural areas. In fact, for the smallest places where a community would have, say, 2,000 people or less, it was 50% oversample. And for places with 2,000 to 3,000 people, it was 1 in 4. So rural areas really had much better data back in the day, if you will. The overall sample for the long form was 1 in 6. Today, the ACS goes to 3.5 million households across the US every year, about 3% of the population, or 1 in 13 housing units. But rural areas are sampled at the same rate as the rest of the population. The other issue is the response rates overall for the ACS. It's dropped from 97% of all households just responding, you know, being civically engaged, as recently as a decade ago, to it's down into the mid 80% now. So that the sample size hasn't changed, even though our population is larger and more diverse, response rates are dropping. It's the Census Bureau no longer goes to every single household that hasn't responded. They only go to a third of them. It's a really big issue with the non-response follow-up. So there's like all kinds of different things feeding in here. And what comes out at the end of this funnel to you, Kelly, is less high quality data, less relevant, less useful data. And it's been really, even the design of the ACS, because of the smaller sample size in rural area, meant that they had to collect data for a 5-year period in order to have a sufficient sample size. So that already builds in a kind of a complication over what was going on with the long form. And so Kelly, I just want to turn it back to you. Those smaller sample sizes have been problematic in your work. Did you want to, like, how big of an issue is that for you?
There are a couple issues that tend to be problematic with the sample size and the ACS in general. As you were mentioning, with the long form census, even though it was once every 10 years that we would essentially get updated numbers, it was really, really reliable, which was nice. The switch to the ACS, I think there were a lot of reasons, right, why the Census Bureau seemed to switch. One of them was particularly larger communities wanted more annual updates, right? Like sooner updates. So you didn't have to wait 10 years to kind of get an update on your area. But the issue, like you were saying, with the low sample size is one, the 5-year averages. And so we get an update to the ACS in our rural areas. Just, this is for our listeners, but it's a rolling average of 5 years. And even though we get the updates every year, it can be kind of hard. Like right now, it's really hard to know to measure the impacts of the pandemic because the pandemic was such a quick blip, 1 to 2 years, but yet our rural data is a 5-year average. And now we're kind of got to wait 5 years to get through that blip to kind of see if we're turning back to normal again. That can be kind of problematic. And that's just, you know, for the data that we tend to use that we know doesn't have large margins of error. So, for example, you brought up childcare. My colleague, Marnie, she tends to use one of the variables that's contained in the American Community Survey, which is looking at households that have working parents with children under 5, I think is the variable table that she tends to use, and then compares that number to the number of childcare slots that are in a region. And that's been really powerful to be able to talk about potential childcare shortages. At least we know anecdotally it's an issue, but then we were able to back it up with some data to say, like, yeah, this is, it's really, it doesn't look good in terms of the number of children that have working parents and the children are under five and the number of childcare slots, right? Like they were not lining up at all. And it's when we produce this information, people really, really enjoy it. And as local kind of county or cities or even maybe regional EDAs have gotten in the game to be like, okay, we want to take on childcare and increase its capacity. Can you give us specific numbers for this county? Unfortunately, we can't do that because of that sample size in the ACS. It's just too big. You know, for example, I remember when I worked at the University of Minnesota Morris, I remember looking up what was the number of people in Stevens County, I think it was, that had a PhD, knowing that the University of Minnesota Morris was there, right? So I just kind of expected it to be high. And it was something like, you know, 325 people plus or minus 150, right? So it's either 100 people or 700, you know, 600 people or whatever, 500 people. That's not useful. And so a very similar thing comes with childcare. Very similar thing comes with even populations in a community that might have folks that are 75 and older. If you're trying to plan on assisted living facilities or nursing home facilities, and the number might be 52 plus or minus 100 sometimes is what we'll see, right? That's not helpful. It's not useful. We can't use it at all. So that tends to be where we get problems. Like we can describe things at a much larger regional scale, which is good too. And that's the power of the ACS. Its weakness is then trying to get our local solutions up and running. So to your question, I think that's kind of the ongoing struggle. And I completely understand with the Census Bureau, it's either you spend a lot of money and send that to more people, or and you do it less frequently, or you try and do it every year, but you reduce the sample size because you're always going to have that pinch on the budget, right? And so there's always that. And I know you guys are constantly looking at this stuff, looking at the legislation, what's being proposed, what's currently being proposed in terms of preparing not only for the next decennial, for the Census Bureau, the decennial census, the ACS, what's currently some of the legislation that's being proposed?
Mary Jo, do you want to jump on with that? Kelly, I love your examples. I think those are just really very helpful.
Well, I don't think there's really any active legislation right now that Congress is considering vis-a-vis planning for the decennial or that would alter the ACS, actively considering. There have been bills introduced, especially in the House, that would, for example, remove the penalties that are currently in place for those who choose not to respond to the ACS. We have had one bill introduced that would terminate the ACS, but these are more messaging bills, as we like to say in Washington, D.C. speak, rather than bills that are, you know, actively on the legislative calendar. I think that Congress is really engaging right now in terms of planning for the next decennial and, of course, keeping its eye on the ACS through its work on the appropriations process. That is the annual process by which they determine the level of funding for all federal agencies. And we're not in a good place right now. I'm happy to elaborate on where we're at, if that would be helpful now, Kelly.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. And if you could touch upon too, you know, what is, you know, I totally understand there's always going to be those bills out there to defund something, or, you know, just somebody's got to be in their bonnet about something, right? I would also be curious, before you kind of launch into where the funding status is, what is some of the, how much has the sentiment changed towards the census over the last 10, 20 years? Is there a certain amount of mistrust, or is it just really about trying to figure out how to prioritize where they're spending money? Like, what's the basis of some of that?
There are still a lot of questions that members raise. I think on both sides of the aisle right now, there are certainly questions about the inclusion of non-citizens in the base that's used to apportion the House of Representatives, and whether or not that is an appropriate policy, and whether or not that policy, although mired in the Constitution, grounded in the Constitution, should be revisited. And that is a debate that probably predates my involvement in these issues, and maybe even Joan's. I mean, this always resurfaces, and seems to coincide, I would say, quite a bit with an election cycle. I don't know, Joan. Do you have some thoughts about Kelly's question to share?
I think these are all really good thoughts. And Mary Jo, I agree with you. This is perennial questions that pop up and down. I do think the one that you mentioned about, it's called Section 621 that's in the current House Appropriations Bill, is worth this audience considering. The idea is that none of the funds could be used to enforce involuntary compliance. So just remember, it's mandatory to respond to the census. It's the seventh sentence of the US Constitution. And it's functional. If people know it's mandatory, and it says that on the envelope when you get, you know, your invitation to participate, you do it. And that, you know, certainly here in Minnesota with high civic participation, people just do it. But this would make it be a voluntary response. What's really interesting about it is one of the national partner groups, the Census Quality Reinforcement Task Force, did a little bit of research that if the Census Bureau had to stop after 2 moments of outreach to households, only 28% of US households would have responded at that point. And no state even achieved 35% coverage. By cutting off the contacts at that point, as much as 2/3 of the US would be left uncounted in 2030. You know, that just can't stand. We also know rural areas are among the most historically undercounted groups. So that wouldn't bode well, Kelly, for you being able to do research and understand what the trends are. I also want to point out one other thing, a piece of evidence, hard data. We love hard data, right? In Canada took this move in at the time of their 2011 census. They have a census every 5 years. So 2011, 2016, 2021. And they decided that they would replace what was their version of the long form with a voluntary survey. Response rates dropped from 94% to 69%. Those who respond were different than those who didn't. And it cost them more money to do this because they had to do more follow-up. So it was a stupid thing to do. A large part of Canada didn't even have data released because the quality was so poor. In fact, Saskatchewan, which is, you know, a largely rural area in the middle of Canada, only had 57% of their data released. They were in a data void at that point. So it was the uproar of community leaders, business leaders, local, small areas who said, this can't stand. And so it was reinstated with the 2016 census, but leaving this big decade-long void. But in terms of the overall funding, the census, the ACS has had uneven funding for the last decade. And so that's always something that the Census Project jumps on every year. They create a stakeholder recommended Census Bureau budget. Mary Jo, maybe you could just talk a little bit about your process and what you've learned.
Yeah, that is something that the Census Project is really known for, and census stakeholders across the board rely on us to develop this annual funding recommendation, which we also then communicate as an educational tool to policymakers to let them know what we think the Census Bureau needs, regardless of what is requested by the president and the budget that goes to Congress, and regardless of what the Bureau says it needs. This is what we think they need. And what goes into that, Kelly, and as Joan knows, because she's part of this process as a member of our advisory committee, is really collaboration with census stakeholders across the data user community and with the administration, meaning people within the Census Bureau, people within the White House to get their perspectives. And then also based on what we think is necessary and achievable, we put out an annual funding recommendation. And I would say it is grounded in the evidence that we collect across the data user community and stakeholder community, but it is in part aspirational because we always want to encourage policymakers to think about what would be possible if they would prioritize funding for the Census Bureau. And so one of the things that we've really uplifted in this document, especially in the last 3 years, has been, as Joan said, the American Community Survey and how on how the fact that underfunding, especially in the last decade in that program, or I should really say stagnant funding, but we think underfunding, has precluded the Census Bureau from being able to do things like increase the sample size, improve non-response follow-up, produce more granular, timely data products, and the list goes on. And we have a report on the Census Project homepage, that is thecensusproject.org, in which we have not only highlighted different uses of the ACS, but also, as I said, outlined seven key enhancements that we've identified that that could improve the usability of the ACS if only we could get additional funds. And to our best efforts in this report, we've identified how much that funding is, but also where we would like more help from the administration, meaning the Census Bureau and the Department of Commerce, understanding what it would take to really make the ACS a more enhanced survey.
The thing that always gets me is that it's just a relatively small amount of incremental funding that will make a big difference in the sample size for the ACS, in making sure that the consumer price index and current population survey have the adequate funding for all these other programs that are necessary and that the Bureau supports. Unemployment rates in Minnesota is done by the Census Bureau through a survey for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So it's just, we're not talking about big amounts of money, but a really big impact.
As important as it is to increase the sample size, and we have some idea of what that might potentially cost, you can't just increase the sample size in a vacuum. You also need to think about, if your sample is bigger, you'll need to boost funding for the non-response follow-up operations, because you're going to have to reach more people. And the Bureau has told us it costs approximately $200 to complete each non-response follow-up activity within the ACS. So increasing your sample size is only solving part of the problem. This has a ripple effect. And so these are other considerations that we've taken into account in the paper that we've put forward and in the recommendations that we've put out as well.
So the strategies, or I should say, increasing the sample size is more like, I want to say, just increasing the number of surveys that go out. But then it's the strategies behind those to make sure that they're responded to that then is like an additional cost to everything as well. So it's not just like, all right, more paper, print it out and send it out the postage, but also how they do the follow-ups. Has there ever been, this is a little bit of a side on the side, instead of a penalization, has there ever been a discussion of incentivizing for, like, if somebody were to take the ACS, they get a tax deductible write-off or something like that? Has that ever been discussed?
I've heard community groups talk about doing something on that order, as using a carrot instead of a stick, but I don't know if it has actually been considered.
Yeah, I don't think it's legal currently. I mean, people have said, yeah, can we give them a Target gift card in exchange for responding? No, you just want to. It's your civic duty. And you should also care about responding, because ultimately your community, your schools, your hospitals, your roads, the things that you take for granted as public goods all benefit from the data that is derived from your response. So that should be for, I know I sound a bit Pollyannish, but I was hoping that would be enough of a carrot to want to entice people to respond to not only the ACS and the decennial census, but any of these federal surveys, because they're all suffering from declining response rates and participation, quite frankly.
Right. Well, that's a nice segue into, talking about what can people do to help support the Census Bureau, as well as maybe getting involved to get a higher response rate. We're going to be ramping up for the next decennial census. I know they're always looking for volunteers. I know it's crazy. It's only 2024, but we're going to start ramping up again. What are some things that you would like people to know about moving forward and how they can participate or help out?
Yeah, thanks, Kelly, for that question. Well, number one, you're doing it right here, everyone, by listening to this podcast. You're already taking a step forward to become more informed, to understand what would happen in your personal world, your community, without accurate, relevant, consistent, timely, and accessible data. Kelly, you've talked about even the access piece of it a little bit. And then share it with your community partners, with leaders and elected officials, that accurate census data help your local area in lots of different ways. So MACS is ramping up for a statewide network to make sure folks understand the importance of participating, a little bit like Mary Jo was talking about, the resources and the changes that happen in your local community, and just staying connected. We've got a website, and you can learn from our newsletters, opportunities to engage, sign on letters, things to nuances that are happening. I do want to mention that the Census Bureau is the world's premier statistical organization. They are fantastic. And what they're doing is not just doing censuses and surveys. They're innovating. They're looking at other ways to address through technology and messaging those declining response rates, different opportunities to use data that's already been collected for other purposes. It's all protected under Title 13 of the Census Bureau Code, making sure that not a single piece of an individual's information can be shared with even another government agency. And I think that fear factor, the mis and disinformation, is they're engaging local partners. They're looking at a number of different innovative ways to make sure that their processing and collection is efficient. I mean, I just have a huge amount of respect for how they're managing this changing world around them, but they need our support. They can't do it alone. And that's where our voices make a difference as constituents.
Yeah, I agree. I guess this gives me a chance to maybe circle back to what we're dealing with right now, vis-a-vis funding for the Census Bureau and how folks could be engaged in the process right now. As I said earlier, the funding trend is moving in the wrong direction. We should be ramping up. And instead, at least on one side of Congress and the House Appropriations Committee, they've put forth a bill that not only contains the policy provision that Joan addressed earlier, the section that would limit the number of follow-up contacts to no more than two, they've also proposed a funding level that is the same as last year's funding level that the Bureau received, and puts them several hundred dollars below where they should be. The Senate Appropriations Committee on the other side of the aisle has put forth a funding recommendation for fiscal year 25, the next fiscal year, that more or less matches what the president put and outlined in his requested budget to Congress. So what's happening right now is members are meeting at least informally because to finalize the fiscal year 25 budget for all federal agencies, including the Census Bureau. We expect to know the outcome of these deliberations sometime after Congress returns in November, because we're expecting Congress to sort of fund federal agencies through the end of December on a temporary spending bill. So census stakeholders are taking advantage of this time right now to really urge support for the Bureau and to communicate what's at stake for the Bureau if it doesn't receive, at a minimum, the amount that the Senate recommended. So I would say staying tuned to groups like MACS and the Census Project. We're trying to keep groups informed about the implications of the funding process and those who choose to engage and communicate their concerns. If they see this funding direction moving in the trajectory moving in the wrong direction, should weigh in.
All right. Thanks. And the Census Project, do you guys have a newsletter or anything that people can sign up for or not?
We do. You can sign up for our materials directly on our homepage. Again, that's www.thecensusproject.org, all one word, censusproject.org. And we have a monthly update where we sort of cover all things census in a one-stop shop document. We also do blogs and engage on social media. So we try to reach a vast network that includes the media about our materials and our news.
Okay. And Joan, do you want to just give our listeners one more update on your website and newsletter?
Sure. Thanks. You can find our newsletter on our website, which is www.minnesotansforacs.org. And you can find lots of information there. We're going to be doing a little bit of updating to the website, but everything should point you to our newest location. I'll also say that every winter in February or March, we meet with all 10 of Minnesota's congressional offices with a group of stakeholders like Kelly, Mary Jo, or her co-director are always at those meetings. So we're providing good information upward. If you're interested in participating in that, just send me an email. You'll find it again on the website, www.minnesotansforacs.org. Long name.
Thanks, yeah. Kelly. All right. Thanks, Joan, Mary Jo. It was Pleasure to have you guys on. Thanks for informing us on the census. Thank you for your great work. I know it wouldn't be possible, or our work, my work that I do every single day wouldn't be possible if you guys weren't there. So thanks again for participating in this and informing our listeners, and have a great week and good luck on the rest of the year.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.